This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network in Latin American Studies, a podcast in the New Books Network. I am Kenneth Sanchez, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I will be talking with Dr. Anna Kant about her very interesting book, Land Without Masters, Agrarian Reform and Political Change Under Peru's Military Government. It is a fresh perspective on the way Peruvian government's major 1969 agrarian reforms transform the social, cultural, and political landscape of the country. Thank you for joining us here today, Anna.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Just a brief bio on Anna. Dr. Anna Kant is a Latin American historian with expertise in 20th century politics, cultural history, and rural development. Dr. Kant has taught in the UK and Colombia and has received scholarships from the Arts and Humanities Research Council and the Liberhume Trust. She is currently an assistant professor of Latin American history at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Anna, perhaps to begin, you can tell us a little bit about yourself and the path that led you to write this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in the UK. I don't have any connections to Peru, but I had a fascination with Latin America from a young age and traveled there as a teenager and really always wanted to go back following that. I did a degree in history and then I did a master's thesis or a master's course in Latin American studies at the Center of Latin American Studies in Cambridge. And I was very fortunate to have as my thesis supervisor, Dr. Gabriela Ramos, who is a very well-known Peruvian historian, who actually focuses on the colonial era. But as someone who had lived through the agrarian reform, she was just a great source of advice and inspiration in studying this topic. So for my master's thesis, I was really interested in the propaganda surrounding the agrarian reform, and I focused on the posters that were used to promote the reform. The thesis ended up being published as a journal article in the Journal of Latin American Studies. And I really enjoyed that whole research experience. You know, I interviewed Jesus Ruiz Durand, one of the artists of the posters, and found some fascinating material in the Peruvian National Library. But I realized through that process that this extended beyond propaganda, that the political impact of the Peruvian agrarian reform took place across many different spheres, and that it varied hugely across the country. So I had an inkling that there were big regional differences in how the agrarian reform was experienced. And that was something I wanted to study further, and that's how my thesis project came about.
That's very interesting, Anna. Your article on the Journal of Latin American Studies, Land for Those Who Work It, a visual essay analysis of agrarian reform posters in Blasco's Peru, is very exciting as well, and people can check that out in the Journal of Latin American Studies. But before we go on about the book, I think it will be valuable for our listeners to know a little bit more about the historical background of your book, Peru, you know, the agrarian reform under Velasco. Perhaps you can briefly tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So we're talking about the 1969 agrarian reform law, 17716. As amazingly, people always remember the numbers of laws in Peru. It always impresses me. This reform was carried out by the Velasco government, Juan Velasco Alvarado, who came to power in a coup in 1968. And it's often referred to as a peculiar revolution, as an unusual case in the Latin America of that time, because it was a government that was a military government, authoritarian in a lot of ways, but also quite progressive in contrast to what was happening in Argentina and Brazil at the time. So the reform was really billed as a necessary change and something that had, you know, there'd been push against this system of the latifundio that saw concentration of land in the hands of very few, while the vast majority were barely able to subsist on small plots of land and were forced to work in often very exploitative conditions. So there had been a couple of attempts at land reform earlier in the 1960s, 1961 and 1964, but both of these attempts had sort of been stymied by entrenched landowner opposition and the ability to kind of get around the law. So the agrarian reform that the Velasco government introduced was explicitly defined as a radical agrarian reform that would redistribute land from large landowners to cooperatives, to peasant cooperatives. And so according to the law, property that exceeded the unaffectable limit, which was roughly the amount needed for a family, could be expropriated by the state. And it was then, once it had been expropriated, the landowners were given some recompense in the form of government bonds. And then the land was adjudicated by the Agrarian Tribunal and the Ministry of Agriculture. And that's often where the kind of the big political battles took place, because there were various competing groups who wanted to claim the land. And the government had a very clear agenda of establishing a cooperative system that was billed as a third way between capitalism and communism. And in that way, it's important to remember that this is an agrarian reform that takes place in the midst of the Cold War, and a desire to distance Peru as from either the Soviet Union or the US, and to kind of promote national independence and a kind of nationally powerful and an autonomous economy. So the reform redistributed more than 40% of the country's agricultural land and did dismantle the latifundio system. But it was billed throughout as an act of justice more than a way of increasing production or efficiency. And in that way, it's quite distinct from the agrarian reforms that were being carried out under the aegis of the Alliance for Progress, for example. But this was a reform that was at the heart of the Velasco government's political revolution to create a more egalitarian and inclusive Peruvian society.
Yes, of course. And now diving more into the book, more specifically, I think it will be useful if we go chapter by chapter, and we covered some of the historical background already, so we can start with chapter 2, but those interested in the historical background and also some of the methods and the studies on the regional studies of the agrarian reform can look into chapter 1. Now, on the second chapter, you examine the work of Sinamos, which you have done before, I believe, in Paolo Drinot's book with Aguirre, A Peculiar Revolution, and you were examining the work of Sinamos and how it adapted its discourse in different regions. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about what you find and how the state attempted to promote the reform in different ways in different places.
Yes, so it's worth saying, for those who don't know, Sinamos was a government agency, the Sistema Nacional de Apoyo a la Movilización Social, system of support for social mobilization. And so the Velasco government had this explicitly no party policy, no political party, including for themselves. So Sinamos was imagined as a kind of activist agency that would facilitate participation rather than taking on a vanguard role and kind of leading from the center. And in that respect, presence in the regions was really sort of central to their view of political mobilization. So there were a series of, there were local level promoters, then there were zonal offices, then regional mm-hmm. offices, and a national office. And this was kind of imagined as a network that would enable to people to participate in politics on their own terms and in their local area. In terms of regional comparison, this was central to the design of the book. And the reason for that is that I wanted to discover how the agrarian reform was debated and experienced on the ground in different regional contexts. So I compare Piura on the northern coast, which is really a centre of capitalist development and became a centre of activism during the agrarian reform. I compare that with Cusco, which is from in the southern highlands and has sort of a long history of peasant politics, peasant unions, and is also culturally more indigenous with a large number of Quechua speakers. And the third place I chose is Tacna, which is characterized by a large number of minifundios and not really large agro-industrial estates like in the northern coast. So I kind of compare the activities of SINAMOS in each of these regions, and how did the promoters that work for the government kind of try and translate the reform into mm-hmm. locally meaningful terms. So I found that the reform was kind of built in different ways in each of these regions. So in Piura, it was very much about gaining control of the means of production and a kind of class struggle. In Cusco, it was about the ancestral claims to the land and continuing a peasant struggle that had been in existence for a long time. In Tacna, it was quite different to either of those cases in that there wasn't such a lot of land available for expropriation, but there was an important sense in which Tacna, which had been occupied by Chile earlier in the 20th century, could participate in a national revolution as well. So even though the mm-hmm. agrarian politics were not as central to the region, nevertheless, being part of this revolution was seen as significant. So I guess beyond the differences and similarities between the region, what I discovered was the way that SINAMOS operated as a arm of the state as well, and the kind of how it facilitated links between national government and local politics. And in particular, I found that there was a consistent effort in each of these three regions to create what Gramsci has called organic intellectuals. So people who mm-hmm. May not have been through any formal education, but could nevertheless take on a leadership role in their local environment and kind of think the community's way through social change. And the thinking behind this was that the Velasco government, was always aware that it wasn't going to last forever, I think. In 1975, Velasco is removed in an internal coup. And so this effort to create organic intellectuals is driven by a desire to sustain the agrarian reform beyond the life of the government. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the interesting legacies, actually, of the reform. I guess the other thing to mention is that this kind of political mobilization at the local level and intervening in disputes with landowners and so on generated a series of tensions. And it really focused attention on rural politics in a way that hadn't been the case previously. So political parties such as Vanguardia Revolucionaria really shifted their focus from urban politics and student politics to engaging in rural issues because they saw that as the place where the real class struggles were going to take place.
Yeah, I think that was a very good summary of what you can find in chapter two. It's very, very interesting how you find those differences as well, and how the reform wants, the idea of the reform was to live on beyond Velasco's government. Mm-hmm. And going to the third chapter now, you look at Velasco's government's use of education, which is one of the many interesting aspects of La Revolución de Velasco. I found it particularly interesting to read how the discourse propelled a new generation, which you have just mentioned. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about this, not from perhaps the Sinamos angle, but from the education point of view.
Sure. So I think education played a central part in the agrarian reform, both in order to facilitate the functioning of the cooperative system, so to kind of develop technical knowledge and the understanding of economic systems, but also in order to feed into wider social change. So this is, we're talking about the 1970s, really, when a lot of this is happening. And there's a popular idea that consciousness is the foundation of social relations, following Paulo Freire, and that education has a key role in developing consciousness. So one of the interesting things I found when I was looking at kind of course programs and educational manuals used with cooperative members is that there's a huge emphasis on ideology and discussing political issues of the day. So it's really education as a kind of imagined as a point of departure for empowerment and for getting more engaged in politics. So that links back to what I was saying about organic intellectuals, that these training courses were used as a way of connecting campesinos and giving them a political platform. And I found this in a series of interventions discussed in the chapter. So I mentioned rural education programs that took place in cooperatives, but there was also ALFIN, which was a national literacy training program, which again followed these ideas of Freire and teaching people to read using concepts and ideas that were relevant to them and that were sort of tangible. So literacy as a step towards wider political engagement rather than just a technical skill to be used in the workplace, for example. And the other important kind of overarching theme in education at the time is the education reform, which is the kind of the 1972 education reform, which is the biggest overhaul of the education system, mm-hmm. I think, in the 20th century, and really expresses this idea of using education to reshape society and to kind of challenge inequalities that have been naturalized. And so education is opened up to new social science perspectives and methods, discussion of things like socioeconomic inequalities, recognition of Quechua, the introduction of bilingual education. So in terms of sort of going back to the point you were making about propelling a new generation, I think that education formed a kind of a key plank in this new vision of Peruvian citizenship that the Velasco government was trying to promote. So it's important to remember that since 1896, vast majorities of campesinos had been denied the vote on the basis that they were mm-hmm. illiterate. And still one of the big criticisms of the agrarian reform is that that the campesinos were not sufficiently educated to take on positions of responsibility in agricultural enterprises. And there's an important racial undertone to this.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
That these are indigenous campesinos, and that if they don't read and write Spanish, then they're not they can't take on those positions of responsibility. The Velasco government's approach was quite the opposite, that you need to educate as you go, and that if you sit around waiting for people to be educated before Nigerian reform happens, then it's never going to happen because there'll be too much resistance from those in power. To give you a few concrete examples of how this education propelled a new campesino generation. Mm-hmm. I found that in Piura, in particular, the training courses were described as having created an esprit de corps among cooperative members. And we see this continuing into the 1980s. So in the 80s, the cooperative Negri Oloa, which was still in existence, used the kind of ideas that had been in vogue in the 70s to push for changes to the marketing of produce and to kind of exercise a much more direct control over prices and organizing kind of local commerce. This kind of education that asserted that campesinos were citizens and that they were ready to take on positions of power and responsibility, I think, was very important in challenging the status quo that had existed prior to the agrarian reform.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now looking at chapter 4, we look at the public discourse of the reform, which is one of the perhaps more studied aspects right now, following the movie, the documental, La Revolución y la Tierra. You look especially at the innovative campaigns, which you have looked at before in your 2012 paper for the Journal of Latin American Studies, which we mentioned earlier. But I found it interesting that you found that despite the nature of the regime, which is authoritarian, it's still an eruption of public debate. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about the public discourse, the campaign of the reform, and of the government itself, and the effects that this campaign had in the population.
Yeah, so when Velasco seizes power, the Congress is closed and elections are suspended throughout the military government. Mm-hmm. But there's nevertheless an emphasis on the campesino voice as a voice of political legitimacy, a source of political legitimacy. And so there's a deliberate effort to create new fora in which these voices could be heard. So you find that government publications make use of campesino correspondence. There are radio fora, which is where the makers of certain radio programs would have a meeting with the listeners following, and that they would be then invited to contribute ideas and suggestions for the subsequent programs. Mm-hmm. There was the introduction of Quechua language broadcasts on both TV and television, and state-sponsored documentaries which centered on rural communities. So there's a real diversification of media content and practices. Paradoxically, although it's an authoritarian regime, actually it's quite an innovative and radical time in the arts in Peru. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of experimental theatre, music, sort of new combinations of indigenous and mestizo art forms. And so all of these things give a great deal of vibrancy to the political propaganda that emerged at this time. And being a military government, they really tended to delegate a lot of this stuff to intellectuals and artists who already were inspired by the idea of agrarian reform. And I think it's that makes the kind of interventions in public discourse so sort of striking, because it's precisely not something coming from a, you know, a stuffy government office. It's it's a kind of outcome of collaboration with a quite diverse set of people. But debate also erupted, I think, because of the huge amount of opposition that the regime encountered, both from the left and from the right. So on the left, you had new left parties like Vanguardia Revolucionaria, the Movimiento de Izquierda Revolucionaria. And on the right, you had APRA and Unión Nodrista. And precisely because of the absence of formal political arenas like the Congress, I think debate got pushed into the media and other social spheres to a much greater extent. So cooperative assemblies, for example, became a kind of a proxy for political party rallies. And the political parties were seeking ways of exerting influence within the trade unions, within the cooperatives, and within other sort of social property organisations that were established in other sectors at the time. So, yeah, I think we kind of tend to think of democracy as like a very civilian thing that has no, you know, can never exist within a dictatorship. But actually, you know, a lot of, if we think about democracy in alternative terms, in terms of political participation, then there are lots of really interesting developments at this time, despite the fact that it's in formal terms, it's a dictatorship.
Yes, definitely. Chapter 5 now looks at the contentious memory of the reform, which is something that's on debate these days as well. Every time there's any mention of Velasco, you look at the contentious memory of the reform, the contested memories. And I think this is a fascinating look at the creation, the circulation, and the use of these memories, which, as I mentioned, are politically significant until this day. What did you find in these memories and people's effort to locate these within a variety of identities? I think that's one of the more interesting aspects I read on the book, as I'm interested in memory. But what more can you tell us about this aspect of the reform?
Yeah, well, I think probably the aspect that is most immediately apparent is that memory of the Agrarian reform is divided along ideological lines.
Yes.
And this is in part because of how the reform was talked about at the time. So it was bound up with political identities forged at the time. So organizations like Sinamos, they had a kind of collective identity that surrounded the Agrarian reform, and the people that worked for the organization had tended to retain that perspective, that this was a good thing, that it was a act of social justice, and that it you know, it really contributed to national development. Similarly, the CNAA, the Confederación Nacional Agraria, which was established by the Velasco government, sees the reform as kind of foundational to a new kind of politics, a new opening for campesino participation. So I think it's kind of a potent political system, a symbol, both for the left and for the right. So on the right, you know, it embodies everything that they see as damaging and dangerous about state-led reform and about, you know, the redistribution of wealth, that this can unleash sort of chaos and lead to economic collapse. And so these are kind of the contrasting narratives that are continually being reproduced. And you notice it every time on the anniversary of the Agrarian reform or on the anniversary of the coup, that these stories get reiterated. But I think there's also been kind of deliberate manipulation in order to kind of silence some aspects of the Agrarian reform and make it that state policies around wealth redistribution are sort of, to use Judith Butler's term, unspeakable, that they become seen as so extreme that they can't be contemplated in policy circles. But I think it's, you know, it's important to look behind that and especially to think about the memories that don't get transmitted within those sort of ideological confrontations. So there are histories of social inequality and racial discrimination that preceded the agrarian reform. And those are often sort of glossed over, particularly with this recent narrative of the Belaunde regime as being a kind of sort of source of stability and kind of moderate politics. You know, actually, that that period in rural areas was characterized by huge racial discrimination,
of course, yeah,
and oppression of campesinos. And so it's important to remember, you know, what it was the agrarian reform was seeking to address. And if we do that, then I think, you know, that also alters how we see land rights and wealth distribution now. And that's why it's particularly important for younger generations to study these things. And I think kind of beyond politics and beyond ideology, the memory of the agrarian reform is also incredibly complicated when it comes to personal relationships and kind of community cohesion. So, you know, Some communities, campesinas, the peasant communities, were created at the time of the agrarian reform, and the whole community, you know, its land earnings were articulated through the agrarian reform. And so in that way, it's foundational for them, but many communities, particularly in the Cusco region, prefer not to talk about the agrarian reform because of the kind of internal divisions that it gave rise to, particularly as regards, you know, who was included in the cooperative, how the land was worked, how who gained most, when who was excluded, particularly in cases where the cooperative lands were later occupied by Tomas de Tierra in the 1980s by communities seeking to kind of take control of agricultural cooperative land. And so there are kind of histories of a lot of social tension that are then very difficult to talk about in the context of memory of the agrarian reform. And so I think, you know, one of the interesting things I found at the local level is how people navigate this and how, you know, in some cases they, you know, recognize their differences and are able to sort of talk about it and remember it in different ways. But in other cases, there's such a history of kind of internal struggle that it becomes quite painful to talk about it, particularly in the aftermath of the internal armed struggle
of course.
1980s.
I wanted to go back to something you mentioned because I think it's useful for the question about the concluding chapter. You mentioned the importance of refocusing the reform's public discussion from economic issues to a larger political debate, and you have touched upon it a bit on the last answer you gave. Perhaps you could develop that a bit more. Explain us what you went more with that, going from the economic issues to a larger political debate, because it is more complicated than that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, Carmen Solis, who studied the Bolivian agrarian reform, makes the point that legal mechanisms and economic provisions can only ever tell part of the story. So what goes into the law doesn't dictate what happens in the reality, and the reality is much more political. So I think it's important to recognise the agrarian reform as an ideological project and an attempt to reshape society. And this is true not just of the Peruvian case, but of other parts of Latin America. So Heidi Tinsman has worked on the Chilean agrarian reform and sees that as a kind of key moment in the reconfiguration of gender roles. And Nancy Lapp has looked at Brazil and Chile and Venezuela and how the agrarian reform there in each of those countries was linked to an expansion of suffrage. So agrarian reform being used literally to expand the number of people that might vote for you or support you. So agrarian reform is really tied into a sort of political systems and political participation. And that kind of doesn't get captured if we insist on analysing the success and failure in terms of, you know, production figures and kind of economic policy.
And just to bring the discussion a bit more back to the times we're living in right now, you mentioned this a few times in your book, but I want to ask directly, how do you think your book speaks to the present day, present state of Peruvian society?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I think, you know, at the moment, there's a lot of discussion of Castillo introducing a new land reform. And it remains to be seen what that will consist of in practice. But I think what it does highlight is that there is a continued need for land reform or you know, interventions in rural areas that will create some sort of redistribution of wealth. And it's likely to be of a very different character to the Velasco government's efforts. You know, we're living in very different times here, but some of the problems really haven't gone away, such as social exclusion, social and racial exclusion, and the dominance of landowners. So the landowners now are not predominantly the kind of traditional large families that they're, you know, elite families that there were in the time of Velasco, but there are these huge companies now, conglomerates, oftentimes who have land holdings that are larger than those that preceded the agrarian reform. And so there is a problem here that still needs to be addressed and that still, I think, is a big drag on you know, economic development and a source of political instability as well. I think another way that the book speaks to current politics is in its exploration of regional politics, which are now so important. Really, there's, you know, often a big breach between what's discussed and what goes on in Lima and what happens in other regions of the country. And so I think the kind of the reasons for those differences and the different dynamics that take place in different regions still need to be grappled with, and kind of viewing that from a historical perspective, I think, is very important. And I think, you know, in a kind of more obvious way, perhaps, the agrarian reform continues to act as a political reference point in debates on politics. You know, almost every election there is some discussion of, you know, what your view is on Velasco or the agrarian reform, and this is a way of judging the politics of particular candidates. And so the reform continues to have a political significance that perhaps transcends what it did in terms of economic policy or agricultural policy.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. That was actually very, very interesting. I didn't want to finish the interview without asking you about recent literature on the agrarian reform. There's a, I don't want to say a renewed interest, but there's definitely a lot of recent body of work that takes a look at local dimensions and places the reform within the larger story of the regions. Also a bit more nuanced as well. What do you think about these recent publications? Perhaps Jamie Hellman's book. There's also José Luis Lenique's book on Puno, I believe. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about what you think about these most recent publications.
Yeah, well, and there's been a lot since those two that you mentioned. And I think it's really exciting to see that people are, you know, examining different dimensions of the period and of the reform. And I think in a lot of ways, the historical distance has made it possible to reach new interpretations and kind of take a more nuanced perspective, you know, as so often happens in history. So one of the things I discussed with Carmen Solis, because we did a joint podcast in the Historias podcast. And she also found that trying to study the Agrarian Reform with the literature of the era was, you know, you would get mired in kind of very politicized accounts that that were somewhat closed in their perspective. Whereas now I think, you know, we have distance from it and we can see that we don't have to categorize the regime as right or wrong or as progressive or reformist. And some of these kind of categories, that these very strong class categories that were used for the analysis in the 1970s and 80s are kind of used with or are kind of being replaced by other frameworks of analysis. And I think in this respect, Enrique Maya's book, Cuentos Feos de la Reforma Agraria, or Ugly Stories of the Agrarian Reform, was you know, a big inspiration for me, and kind of really sort of pushed off this idea of viewing the reform from different perspectives simultaneously and not trying to enforce a single interpretation. And that's been built on by others. So there's just recently a book came out on the experience of the agrarian reform in Ayacucho by Jaime Urrutia and others. And Rolando Rojas has written a book on agrarian reform in La Convención, and he does the kind of prehistory of Velasco's reform by showing, you know, how much peasant activism there was in the 60s and that how much change that actually achieved even before Velasco's reform. And so I think these kind of different regional perspectives are really important, and they help us to see kind of the contrasting experiences.
Yeah, definitely. And perhaps before we end this interview, anything else you might want to add about the book that perhaps we haven't touched upon in the interview, or perhaps you want to develop something that we haven't talked in depth enough?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as a historian, probably I always want to talk about sources. It's such a cliche. But I think, you know, it's important to recognize that the agrarian reform is difficult to study through sources, because a lot of the more usual things that you might use are not accessible. So in the National Archives, there's a large amount of material relating to the agrarian reform, but it's not been catalogued. And so it's not accessible to researchers. And also, given that the Velasco government ended in a coup, and that subsequently there was a strong push from central government away from the agrarian reform and trying to disassociate from it, there's been very little attention to preserving the archives of that era. And this contrasts with other places like Mexico, where the agrarian reform was really a central part of the pre's narrative about Mexican politics. And so in my case, I had to be quite creative in what sources I could use. But actually, I think, you know, as sometimes happens, unexpected things emerged by doing that. And I found in particular that sources that are not often used for studying land reform, like posters and pamphlets and film, actually are an incredibly rich source, precisely for analysing the kind of ideological and political dimensions of land reform.
Thank you very much, Anna, for the interview. But before we finish, what new projects are you working on right now?
So I'm still very much interested in Peru. I'm working at the moment on a book chapter centering on the work of intellectuals during the Velasco regime, and particularly a publication by Sinamos called Participación, and looking at how kind of progressive intellectuals position themselves within the regime and the kind of conflicts that emerged between civilians and military officials, and how to kind of promote the reform or promote the revolution through text. And this is a project that forms part of a wider book, an edited volume by Carlos Aguirre and others on El Estado Editor, so the state as editor and the ways in which the state in Latin America has intervened in publishing with a wide variety of effects. The other interest that has really developed since I finished my PhD is radio. So following my PhD, I went to Colombia and did a postdoc at the Universidad de los Andes. And I looked at the archive of Acción Cultural Popular, which is an incredible Catholic radio organization established in the late 40s that continued to the late 80s and was centered on literacy training for campesinos. So again, it's this question of communication in rural areas. And I think this is a really sort of interesting question at the time at which you still have high rates of illiteracy. And yet there's a lot of interest in the political mobilization of campesinos and also a lot of anxiety. So ACPO is a very different organization to SINAMOS in that they're trying to promote really modernization in the US mold and kind of encouraging campesinos to be sort of self-supporting and centered on the family unit. There's no discussion really of like national organizing. I look at the kind of ways in which ACPO communicates its vision of modernization and what response this gets from Colombian peasants.
That all sounds very interesting, Anna. We're all looking forward to it. Thank you very much again for joining us here on the New Books Network in Latin American Studies to talk about your recently published book, Land Without Masters, Agrarian Reform and Political Change Under Peru's Military Government.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's all from us here at the New Books Network. Have a good day.